Reading genomes, inventing phones, faster computers, there comes a time when everything changes and the field and discovery takes off. Now it's planets. Meet five astronomers, Professor Deborah Fisher from Yale, Jesse Christensen from Caltech via Queensland, Aki Roberge from NASA, Jennifer Wiseman, Hubble, and Patty Boyd, Chief Exoplanets and Stellar Lab at Goddard. They're at the AAAS doing a press conference.
The discovery of the first exoplanet in 1995, we've gone from zero to thousands of exoplanets. Now, when we look up at the twinkling stars in the night sky, we know that there are planetary systems orbiting virtually every one of those stars. This has been a rapidly accelerating research field, and we now stand on the threshold of the next chapter, the next era of discovery. This will take us from the discovery of the first worlds around other stars, I think, to the discovery of life on those planets. New ground-based instruments are being designed with the goal of detecting planets that have a mass similar to the Earth and that orbit at a distance from their host stars, where liquid water could reside on the surface of the planet. My team has been working on one of these instruments. It's called the Extreme Precision Spectrograph, not too imaginatively named, EXPRESS. This has been designed and built by my team, and we're actually setting up observations to begin right now at the Lowell Observatory near Flagstaff, Arizona, at the end of next week. We've designed this instrument to provide extremely precise, extremely high fidelity data that will deliver a precision that's a factor of 10 better than current spectrographs. This will allow us to measure the speed of stars with a precision or at a level of inches per second. It's almost unimaginable to me. But more broadly, we're also entering an era of giant ground-based telescopes. These 30-meter class telescopes are going to revolutionize astronomy, giving us new eyes on the universe. U.S. astronomers are building the giant Magellan Telescope in Chile and the 30-meter telescope in Hawaii. But some research requires a clarity, a level of clarity that you can only get by being above the Earth's atmosphere. And today we're going to tell you about an exciting lineup of space-based telescopes as well. The James Webb Space Telescope and TESS will be launched in this year. And NASA has organized studies of four key grand mission concepts. Aki Roberge and I are helping to lead one of those studies, the Large Ultraviolet Optical Infrared Telescope. And the other studies are for the Habitable Zone Explorer, HABEX, the Origin Space Telescope, and the Lynx X-ray. So I hope that we're going to have a great lineup that will be a lot of fun today.
So Deborah's introduced you to some of the new exquisite instruments that are being built on the ground to detect and characterize extrasolar planets. I wanted to give you a sense of the incredible pace of exoplanet discovery today. So the NASA K2 mission, which is one of the space missions that Deborah talked about, uses the Kepler satellite to observe stars in the ecliptic plane, tens of thousands of stars at a time, for up to 3 months. At the end of the 3 months, the data, almost 100 million observations, are downloaded from the satellite. Astronomers immediately start poring over the data, but there are more observations than we can actually get through in real time. For instance, yesterday, 95 new planets were announced from the K2 mission from the first 2.5 years of K2 data, and we're actually at the end of year 4, so you can see we're getting a bit behind. But this is where we turn to the power of the crowd, the incredible, enthusiastic citizen scientists who are out there who just want to jump in and help us find Earth 2.0. So inspired by Planet Hunters, which was the original citizen science project using Kepler data that Deborah started, my colleagues and I started Exoplanet Explorers, which presents potential planet candidate signals from the K2 data to the audience and asks, is it a planet? Yay or nay? So 1 month ago, we uploaded 55,000 potential new planet candidate signals to Exoplanet Explorers. In that month, we've had nearly 500,000 classifications from nearly 3,000 active users. Some of them are very active. Two have actually analyzed all 55,000 signals on their own, which is a heroic effort. That means we've had an average of about 9 classifications per signal, and we set our threshold at 10, which is one of the reasons why the results I'm showing today are just preliminary. So from those 55,000 signals, we've identified 94 promising new planet candidates. So K2, because it only observes stars for a few months at a time, only is sensitive to short period planets. Now, if you recall, the shortest period planet in our solar system is Mercury, with a period of 88 days. So all of these planets are much hotter than the shortest period planet in our solar system. None of these are likely to be habitable. But finding systems with short period planets is a stepping stone to finding systems with long period planets. It tells us where to look. And for instance, Aki is going to tell us later on the panel one of the ways we might characterize longer period planets around these stars. I want to stress again that these are just planet candidates. Now that the citizen scientists have returned to us this list, it's our job to go and make the extra observations to confirm that these are really planet signals and not something masquerading as a planet signal. For instance, everything above about 8 Jupiter radii could very well be a small star masquerading as a big planet, since they're about the same size. But that's why we need these precise instruments, like Deborah explained, to go and measure the masses of these objects and say, ah, yes, it's really a Jupiter and not a small star. So I just wanted to stress that these discoveries are coming in faster than we can characterize them. So the more instruments we have, the better off we are. Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse. Good morning. What does it mean for a planet to be habitable? We define the habitable zone, or the Goldilocks zone, as the distance from a star which is not too hot or not too cold, but just right for liquid water to pool on its surface. And we're lucky here on Earth to be in the sun's habitable zone. But is that enough? We know that the sun's nearest neighbors are typically quite a bit smaller and cooler than the sun. These red dwarf stars are between 10 and 50% the size of the sun, and they make up nearly 70% of the stars in the solar neighborhood. And Kepler has shown us that these cool dwarf stars host small exoplanets, and about 20% of these small exoplanets around these small stars are in their so-called habitable zones. But the habitable zone for a red dwarf star is about 10 times closer to that star. And while red dwarf stars are small and cool, there's one way that they completely outdo the sun. They can be extremely magnetically active. This is an image of the sun from SOHO and an artist's rendition of a small star called DGCVN, which is a red dwarf. This shows you the largest flare detected on the sun, so-called X45 flare, spewing out all kinds of light, visible light, X-ray and ultraviolet light, and high-energy particles. And by contrast, that is a flare that was discovered on DGCVN by the SWIFT satellite, which is a satellite in space that NASA launched to detect gamma-ray bursts from their high-energy radiation. The SWIFT satellite triggered on this huge flare from DGCVN. It's about 10,000 times brighter than the brightest solar flare we've seen from the sun. Imagine what that would do to a small planet that was 10 times closer to that star. We're just poised at the time where we're going to launch a satellite called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS. And this is an image of TESS that was released yesterday. This is the satellite all put together and ready for launch at the Kennedy Space Center. And this represents years of work from a team all over the U.S., led by MIT, with lots of NASA involvement at Goddard, at JPL, at Ames. And we are ready to launch TESS in about 2 months. It's going to do a near all-sky survey looking for transiting exoplanets in much the same way that Kepler did, but at the closest stars. It's also going to give us an opportunity to study the variability of those stars in great detail. We can combine the data from TESS, which operates in the optical, with ground-based radio telescopes, which will tell us a lot about the synchrotron radiation and other radiation that's tied to particles coming off of stars, and to satellites in space that measure X-ray and UV radiation to get a simultaneous multi-wavelength picture of the variability of flare stars, like the close stars, the small stars to our sun. So this is actually a region of the sky that many people are familiar with, the Pleiades star cluster, also known as the Seven Sisters. And you can see each one of those little squares is a Kepler postage stamp that's actually animating the real day that comes down from the Kepler spacecraft. And what was happening was that those stars were rotating and they were variable. These stars are called the Seven Sisters because they were born from the same parent cloud. But you can see that their behavior is anything but identical. They're actually very, very different, even though they're sisters. And if you have a sister, you're very familiar with how that works. So TESS will be able to do this for nearly the entire sky, get this kind of data on all types of stars and their variability, including those that host exoplanets. And we will, for the first time, have a comprehensive set of data that will allow us to study the space weather near stars that host exoplanets. And we're hoping that that will be a good way for us to pick the best candidates for those great observatories like Hubble and Webb to take the next steps and really characterize those potentially habitable atmospheres. Thank you.
So, good morning. I wanted to pick up on what you've already heard, which is that we are using a whole suite of telescopes on the ground and in space to study exoplanets. And that suite includes the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, Hubble has been operating since its launch in 1990, so it's almost 28 years old now, but it's still in prime scientific shape right now. In fact, it's more powerful scientifically now than ever before. Because we've had a series of astronaut servicing missions over the years that have kept Hubble fresh with new instruments, and also we're using Hubble in ways that really were not even thought about when it was first launched. And one of those ways is to study exoplanets. Hubble was the pioneer for understanding atmospheres of exoplanets by analyzing them through the transit method of looking at their atmospheres as the planet passes in front of its parent star. Since then, these techniques have been honed, and Hubble is now playing a key role in analyzing exoplanet atmospheres from many different types of exoplanets. So that's kind of the way it works. Our telescopes will look at a star that has a planet that happens to be orbiting along or near the plane of our line of sight. As the radiation from the star passes through the atmosphere of an exoplanet, that atmosphere can absorb some of the components of light before it reaches our telescope. And so we can look at the spectrum and see something about the composition of the atmosphere or the characteristics of the atmosphere. An example of what was done recently using Hubble and the Spitzer Space Telescopes to study the atmospheres of some of the planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system, which is a very exciting system of planets. There are seven more or less Earth-sized planets in that system, and some of them appear to be in the habitable zone of their parent star. So these are the kinds of things we're doing with Hubble. Hubble is not really good at detecting and finding. It's not the finding machine for exoplanets, but it is excellent for characterizing some features of atmospheres, including water vapor, as Hubble has been key in finding water vapor in several exoplanets at this point. We're doing a major survey of exoplanets that we can detect with Hubble right now, looking at their atmospheres. And we're using Hubble also to prepare for future observatories, to understand what we can in the wavelengths that Hubble can achieve, to help us also prepare for what we might be able to learn with future telescopes. One example of this is the James Webb Space Telescope, which will launch in 2019. We expect Hubble will continue to operate very well far into the 2020s. So these two observatories should be operating simultaneously and in a complementary way. And there are many interesting features in the spectra of exoplanets that show up in visible light as well as infrared light and ultraviolet for that matter. Hubble can see visible ultraviolet and somewhat into the infrared. The James Webb Space Telescope will see much farther into the infrared region of the spectrum. So these two observatories will be complementary. The James Webb Space Telescope has a much larger aperture. That means that it can see as sharply as Hubble can, even at these longer wavelengths of light. So we're looking forward to having both of these observatories, as well as others, operating in concert in the future. And in fact, the early release science from the James Webb Space Telescope that has already been announced includes some key projects that will be observing exoplanets, both imaging them and also taking spectral analyses of some of these exoplanets using the instruments on the Webb telescope. So it's a very exciting time, and right now Hubble time on exoplanets has tripled in the past few years. We're using almost 20% of Hubble time to look at exoplanets. That shows how exciting this is. And so we have a bright future ahead of us as Hubble operates and prepares for James Webb. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess I want to start off by saying that it's really kind of absolutely amazing that the reality of what exists out there in worlds among the stars, they're far more abundant, far more diverse than even, I think, the dreams of science fiction. So we have really lucked out in this. And it's partly that huge abundance and diversity that has allowed us to study exoplanets with instruments and telescopes that were not designed to do it. But all of these exciting discoveries, they really encourage us to aim for a more ambitious goal. And for the first time, we actually have the information to design an experiment that can answer an ages-old question, like, are there worlds like Earth among the stars, and do any of them have life? So for astronomers, this experiment hinges on being able to take actual images of small rocky planets around stars like the Sun. We need to move to change our techniques from the transit observations that we're using today and tomorrow to actually do what's called high contrast imaging. How to suppress the extremely bright Sun by a factor of 10 billion using a coronagraph instrument on a large space telescope. So now, once you've done that, the planets can emerge from that intense glare. Jupiter and Venus are easily visible, and there is the pale blue dot of Carl Sagan's imagining. But images of pale blue dots, as attractive as they are not the real goal. So what we need to do is take that light from that's coming from the planet itself and make a spectrum. And doing this reveals a wealth of information about the planet's atmosphere and its surface. So just to walk through it, on the far left, the rise in brightness is literally our blue sky. There's a deep, narrow dip there that's marked with the tree. That comes from molecular oxygen, which comes from photosynthesis. The several really broad, deep dips come from water vapor, and their strength and depth in Earth's atmosphere point to the presence of liquid water on the surface, which is, I think, as somebody mentioned, a key ingredient for life on Earth. And then over on the far right is part of a methane feature. And nearly all the methane in our atmosphere comes from bacteria in the guts of our livestock and in swamps. So Earth's atmosphere is teeming with what we call biosignatures. So these are gases that couldn't be present without life. And this is what astronomers want to try and see on worlds around other stars. So for the last 2 years, NASA has been studying and designing two future space observatories that could make these kinds of observations in preparation for the 2020 National Academy's Astrophysics Decadal Survey. The other observatory concept is called the Habitable Exoplanet Imaging Mission. And the interim reports on both of these studies will be submitted to NASA next month and will become public not long afterwards. So LUVOIR is a concept for a space telescope with a diameter in the range between 8 and 16 meters. So that's, roughly speaking, about twice the size of the James Webb Space Telescope. So you could really think of it as a super-duper Hubble, because it spans a similar wavelength range. And like Hubble, it would enable a revolutionary range of general astrophysics and solar system observations, but it will also have the power to find dozens of exo-Earth candidates, small rocky planets, in the habitable zones of sun-like stars, and then probe them to see if they actually have Earth-like conditions in their atmospheres and surfaces. And so with a LUVOIR launch in the late 2030s, we could finally learn about our uniqueness in the universe and possibly find a true Earth 2.0.
This is The Science Show at a AAAS press conference in Texas with Professors Deborah Fisher, Jesse Christensen, Aki Roberge, Jennifer Wiseman, and Paddy Boyd on the shape of things to come and getting to know those planets, hundreds of thousands of them being discovered every day.
I'm Alan Boyle with GeekWire. You mentioned the Earth 2.0 in the late 2030s, but I don't know who would like to address the idea of the hunt for Earth-like planets and give a time frame. Will we have to wait until the late 2030s for that?
Let's see. I think a really important thing to do is to characterize what we mean by Earth 2.0, because there are lots of announcements, right? Every week you guys have seen a new first Earth-like planet discovered. So do we mean the mass of the planet? Do we mean its separation from its host star so that it's likely to host liquid water? Do we mean the radius of the planet? Do we mean something about the convective internal processes which present a stable atmosphere? And I think we have this bucket that we're calling Earth-like planets, and we're throwing a lot of things into that right now, which is the right thing to do, because then we have this bucket that we can begin to sieve and see which of them really are the best candidates for for life. So what we're hoping to do, the Geneva team just commissioned Espresso in the Southern Hemisphere. My team is right now commissioning Express in the Northern Hemisphere, and we are both aiming for 10 centimeter per second precision, which is the amplitude, the radial velocity that the Earth induces in the Sun. And so we're really trying to get at Earth-mass planets at distances from their host stars where liquid water could reside. Now, whether or not they're really Earth-like, right, they have atmospheres and biosignatures, we're going to need to have a space mission for this. So I would love to have a shortcut and get the answer right away. This is just, it's going to be a process, but I think there will be progress before the 2030s in finding more of these candidates. They'll come from tests, they'll come from the ground-based missions.
So will Express find the Earth-like planets that LUVOIR can then follow up and get spectral signatures of?
That is our hope, right? Because we'll be surveying the nearest stars, the brightest stars, and having the nearby stars for as targets for LUVOIR is also important. There, the angular separation matters, and so if the star and planet system is closer, then you can hope to resolve the planet separately from the host star. So I'm hoping that this will be a continuum of discovery.
And I think we should also add, if you're impatient, that TESS, which is launching right away, will be surveying. Tell us a little more about what you'll see in the near term with TESS. Yeah.
So TESS is designed to detect exoplanets orbiting nearby bright stars, much closer than those that were detected by Kepler, because they are much easier to characterize with the larger telescopes because your signal-to-noise is higher with nearby brighter stars. So TESS will survey 85% of the sky in its first two-year survey mission. We're going to launch no earlier than April 16th.
This year.
That's right. Very soon now. There'll be a 60-day commissioning period where we'll check out the cameras, make sure that everything's working properly, and then we will start our first observing segment, which will cover 24 degrees by 96 degrees. So a very large swath of the sky will sit there and stare for 27 days straight, looking for those tiny dips that indicate transiting planets. And once we do that, the team is poised to prioritize those and take them to ground-based telescopes to see which ones are the best targets to then further characterize with the larger telescopes. So it won't be long.
Okay, but there's an important point we have to talk about here, and that is, can you have habitable planets around stars that are different than the Sun? This is a super important thing that we want to find out. So just to clarify, so the small planets TESS will find that are orbiting in the habitable zones of their stars will all be around red dwarf stars, small, very active stars like the one that Patty highlighted. And those stars are relatively speaking, far more active than the Sun. And it will be very interesting to start finding out if planets around stars like that can have atmospheres and can have liquid water on their surface. So TESS will find those planets. JWST will begin to characterize them. But then again, you know, just being in the habitable zone of your star doesn't mean you're habitable, obviously. I mean, just look at the solar system. We basically have three rocky planets that are pretty either in or very close to the habitable zone. We got Venus, Earth, and Mars. And they couldn't be more different from each other. I mean, one of them has an incredibly dense, hot, inhabitable atmosphere. One of them's practically a bare rock. And then there's Earth. So to take that real step and turn all of those habitable planet candidates into finding out if they're actually habitable is what we need, the direction we need to go in. We'll start with the easier ones, which is the small planets around some small stars. But eventually, I think we all think we need to look at planets around sun-like stars too, ones that are like the solar system. And that's what LUVOIR and HABEX are intended to do.
So I don't think we can answer your question of when we will detect that planet, but I think that we can give you a lot of information about, are we on the right path? Are we doing the right things to tell if a planet is truly Earth-like or habitable? And one of the most exciting things about answering that question is it really requires all of our scientific knowledge of not just stars and planets, but our own solar system and atmospheric modeling. Understanding the Earth's atmosphere as a function of time, there's a tremendous amount of multidisciplinary science that goes into answering that question, and I think that right now it's very exciting that we're putting all those pieces together.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Sachs. I'm with NOVA on PBS. I'm curious to understand a little bit more about the Express instrument. We just learned about how TESS and Kepler are looking at planets around red dwarfs. Is the Express instrument looking at those same star systems, and Can you elaborate a little bit more on how it's improving on the technology that we already have?
Sure. Thank you. Yes. So first of all, I should say that we'll be using the radial velocity technique or the Doppler technique to measure the velocity of stars. And so my career in astronomy has spanned the discovery of the first exoplanets. We have a lot of data on nearby stars, and my favorite targets are the stars where we think that there's nothing there, right? With the precision that we've measured at Lick Observatory, Keck Observatory, you know, all the observatories that we have right now, we haven't been able to find anything. But we have large error bars, and we have some really important information from the Kepler space mission, which tells us that nearly all stars have planets. So those stars must have planets, and they must be the most interesting kind of planets, the small rocky worlds that we're really after. So that's how it works and the goal. Now, why is the precision better than the precision that we have right now? We've spent the last couple decades trying to figure out what it is that prevents us, right? That stands between our ability to detect an Earth-like planet around a nearby star. And to give you some perspective, right now, we're measuring the shift of spectral lines back and forth, right, as a star goes away from us and comes towards us. And we always emphasize that it's going back and forth as if it's some big macroscopic phenomenon. But in fact, we're measuring shifts of spectral lines right now with a precision of 1/1000th of a pixel, right? That is staggering. And what we're proposing to do is to take that a factor of 10 down to 1/10,000th of a pixel shift. So we've done several things with XPRESS. First of all, we've made sure that it's incredibly stable. The first thing we did was to dig a hole in the concrete floor of the observatory, the Discovery Channel telescope at Lowell Observatory, and pour our own concrete pier that's very deep and that's vibrationally decoupled from the rest of the telescope. We've put it in a vacuum enclosure so we can stabilize the temperature and pressure. We've increased the resolution beyond the resolution of what other planet hunting telescopes use. So our resolution is between 130 and 150,000. And we've added things that have only been invented in the last decade, laser frequency combs for wavelength calibration. And then even after we do all of that and we build the very best instrument that really can measure Doppler shifts of 10 centimeters per second, we have to deal with something else, which is that we're looking at stars and the surface of the star has huge velocity flows. So can we decouple? And that's what it's really come down to. In the next 2 years, will we be able to decouple the velocity flows that come from the surface of the star from the velocity of the star as it's orbiting a common center of mass? And the work that we've done has told us that high signal to noise and high resolution is important, that those velocity flows are actually imprinted in the spectrum in a subtly different way than the orbital velocities. And so we're banking on our ability to be able to pull this out with some new statistical analysis tools and with a very broad wavelength range that will help us to see these features.
I'm Ryan Mandelbaum from Gizmodo. I know that LUVOIR would be sort of this big telescope that would be going up in the 2030s, but given the recent decision to axe W first, are you worried at all about actually getting that telescope up? And how are you fighting to ensure that a telescope like that can go up?
W first isn't dead yet.
Yeah, not dead yet. It's only a flesh wound. Well, I certainly hope that we will, the scientific community and NASA, will continue to do great things, truly ambitious new things. I'm going to operate under the assumption that that's true.
The field is incredibly fluid, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to see 15 years from now. I think there was a time when people couldn't imagine building a Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah. And I think the key to making sure that we can do that, the scientific community and NASA in particular, is to have big goals. And goals that the society, that not just scientists can get behind, but that the public, the society, humanity can get behind. And I have to say, I think that finding another planet that's actually like Earth and finding out the uniqueness of life in the universe is a big deal. And so in one sense, I think the more powerful and the broader the science case of a facility, the better chance it has.
Hi, I'm Lee Hotz with the Wall Street Journal. If I may ask a question of Jesse. about the Exoplanet Explorer. I wonder if you could tell us first what the step-by-step process is that you'll have to go through to take the candidates that have been delivered to you by your citizen scientists and then confirm them. And then secondly, what's your schedule for giving them the next package of observations to paw through?
Great, thank you. Good questions. So to turn a planet candidate into a confirmed planet or a validated planet, we have to do a number of things. One is that we have to go and examine the neighborhood of the star that we think has the signal. One thing that can often trip us up is if that star has an eclipsing binary, so two stars that are orbiting each other along the line of sight, either in the foreground or the background. The combination of the light from all three stars can add together and look like a planet going around a star where it's really three stars. We can do that by using very high-resolution adaptive optics imaging of the star and really like look as close as we can to that star and see what's around. Another thing we do is, once we know the star is isolated, is to measure the parameters of the star very well. A lot of the parameters of the stars we have for K2 are not as precise as we'd like, so maybe sometimes we have the star wrong, and then you think it's an Earth-sized planet, and actually it's a Neptune-sized planet because you didn't know the size of the star. So we'll go and we'll get better parameters for the size of the star. Once we know it's an isolated star that we know well, we have two choices. One is we think there's a chance of measuring the mass using radial velocity, using the technique that Deborah was talking about. If it's an exciting enough candidate that we want to go spend our precious radial velocity resources on it, we'll go and we'll try and measure the mass. If we don't think we'll be able to measure the mass, like the star is too faint or the planet's too small, we can statistically validate it as a planet. And what that means is we compare the signal that we see to all of the other types of signals that could create that sort of signal, and we basically say we eliminate ones where it's just as likely to be a star as a planet, and typically we set the threshold at 99%. If it's 99% probable that it's a planet signal compared to a star signal, we say it's validated as a planet. So it's a statistical argument. So those are the steps to take something from a planet candidate to a confirmed or validated planet. In terms of the time scale, so what we have given the Exoplanet Explorers at the moment is the fourth year of K2 observations. There's a campaign 16, which is the first quarter of the fifth year of observations, which is happening right now, actually. And that those data will come down and we'll process them as quickly as possible and put those up. K2's fuel will run out at some point. We're hoping we get through campaign 17. We might not. So there might not be much more data from K2, but TESS is going to launch in 59 days, no earlier than 59 days. Not that I'm counting, I'm very excited. And TESS is going to have an even worse problem than Kepler in terms of the amount of data coming down because of the size of the sky that we're looking at. So as quickly as we can, we plan to have TESS objects on Exoplanet Explorers as well. There will be no shortage of data. So that's what's happening right now. The campaign 16 data needs to come down, it needs to get processed, and we need to look for the potential signals, then we need to upload them. So that's probably 2 months away before they get that data. And then fingers crossed we get campaign 17 as well.
Audience would be interested to hear about biosignatures. You showed an Earth-specific biosignature. Would the biosignatures look the same on other planets as you're detecting them from telescopes?
No, in fact. The spectrum I showed earlier, that was the modern Earth, which has lots and lots of oxygen in its atmosphere. But for about two-thirds of Earth's inhabited history, there was very little oxygen in the atmosphere, for example. So like during the Archean Earth, those are not the biosignatures you'd be looking for in the Archean Earth. There'd be a lot more methane and probably an organic haze than in the Proterozoic Earth, where photosynthetic life is starting to evolve and the oxygen levels are building up. So there's oxygen in the atmosphere, still relatively high amount of methane, but not enough oxygen that you could actually detect it, that particular spectral feature I was pointing out. You'd actually want to target ozone. Using the ozone absorption feature, you can measure much smaller concentrations of oxygen in the atmosphere. So just looking at the three Earths are like three different variants of what an inhabited planet can look like over, you know, billions of years. And so we are trying to keep that in mind while we're designing LUVOIR and HABEX. So we don't know what the full range of biosignatures from possible life could be. We can't know that. This is the experiment to find out. But at the very least, we do have these three examples of three very different Earths in front of us that we can use to guide how we actually design the experiment and design the instruments, and we are doing that.
If I could add something to the conversation about, you know, this drive to find what Earth-like planets, whatever that means, that drive fits in a larger picture of study of exoplanet systems in general, because we really need to understand how these systems form, what their characteristics are, how they may have changed over time. And so that is why we are interested in looking at not only the planets that are the size of Earth orbiting sun-like stars in the habitable zones. That of course, is a prime goal, as we've been discussing. But we're also very interested in these other very un-Earth-like planets, these big, what we call hot Jupiters, which are these big gas giants that are orbiting very close to their parent star, or other gas giants that are orbiting farther out from their parent star, planets that have very different compositions from the planets in our own solar system. We're interested in all of that because it helps us understand whether our solar system is typical of planetary systems or whether our solar system is unusual. So that is why we continue to take an interest in a wide swath of stars and planets. Mm-hmm. And we can also find some interesting things about the character of these exoplanets. I think astronomers have been really clever to use these tiny signals that we're getting from these systems and maximize the amount of information you can get out of it. For example, this TRAPPIST-1 system, which has been much in the news of late, the study of these seven planets orbiting their tiny little parent star have revealed a whole lot of information with a very small amount of data. So we now can understand, for example, with Hubble and Spitzer observations of these planets, that it appears their atmospheres, at least for several of them, are not big and puffy, you know, hydrogen-dominated huge atmospheres that would create a greenhouse effect on some of these planets. In fact, they seem to be more compact atmospheres, more like the atmosphere of Earth. And so that is a clue, right? So all of these things that we're detecting are clues that we add into the bigger picture we're trying to build of what these exoplanet systems are like. Another thing that we're using telescopes for, including Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope, is to study these environments around stars where planets form, these disks of dust and gas out of which planets coalesce. So we're finding now that these disks are very common around stars as they form. These are the planet-forming zones, and as we understand more and more about these planet-forming zones and how they vary from star to star, we can understand better the types of exoplanet systems that we would be expecting to be forming around different types of stars. And again, whether our solar system is typical or atypical. So that's the broader picture in which these exoplanet studies fit. Yeah.
My personal research actually is in the area of planet formation. And I just have to say a couple of things here. You know, I can think of like four ways to prove from planet formation theory that planets cannot form. So it's really important to understand that the exoplanets we have discovered, they break the theories. They really have broken the theories. They are vastly more diverse. They form in vastly more what we would have thought were extremely hostile environments. And it would be nice if planet formation theory, our studies of planet formation, were predictive of what we see, but they just aren't. So this is certainly a case where nature was far more inventive and robust than planet formation theorists.
So many planets, so much work, and yes, they need you to help. There we heard Patty Boyd from Goddard Space Flight Center, Jennifer Wiseman from the Hubble Project, Aki Roberge from NASA, Jesse Christensen, the Australian at Caltech, and Deborah Fisher of Yale. Music, of course, by Gustav Holst. And if you're in New South Wales, on the Central Coast, in a couple of weeks, you can attend a performance of that music, plus a star lecture by star astronomer Fred Watson. It's on April the 7th, Central Coast Grammar, near Gosford. A link in the Science Show website. And Fred's always tremendously good fun, as you know. By the way, the current edition of National Geographic magazine, the March edition, has a feature on what makes a Goldilocks planet like the Earth. What features you need, 13 of them. Next week on The Science Show, artificial intelligence and rewiring the brain and central nervous system with carbon. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.